It is a special blessing to be able to worship with you today. It has been a bizarre week, hasn't it? And I am so glad that it worked out that we are able to be together today. It just, in addition to the blessing of worship, it just kind of restores a little sense of normalcy, doesn't it? And I'm very, very thankful to that. Thankful, as Kenneth already mentioned, that God has blessed us and brought us safely through the storm. This morning, I want to invite you to Matthew chapter 7, if you will go there. And I want to read a little bit, beginning in verse 1. And then I want us just to work through this piece of text this morning. Matthew 7, starting in verse 1. Are you there in your Bible? Jesus says, "Do not judge so that you will not be judged. For in the way you judge, you will be judged. And by your standard of measure, it will be measured to you. Why do you look at the speck that is in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, 'Let me take the speck out of your eye,' and behold, the log is in your own eye? You hypocrite. First, take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye." I am suspicious that Matthew 7 may be replacing John 3:16 as the most familiar Bible text. Maybe Jeff even Psalm 23. I don't know that anybody is holding it up during the end zone when they kick the extra point, but I do hear people talk a lot about Matthew 7 and verse 1, don't you? Do not judge, Jesus said. I think as our culture gets more and more nebulous on the subject of morality and right and wrong, people increasingly do not like it when someone suggests that their behavior is wrong. And when that happens, this verse often becomes the reply. Wait a minute, don't say I'm wrong, because you've heard it, haven't you? You have no right to judge me. In fact, it's especially useful if the person judging is a Christian, because then they can cite Jesus to back them up. Even Jesus said, don't judge, right? I wanted you to think with me about that. You've heard Jeff and I talk about this before. I wanted you to think with me about that because I think that reality has impacted what we typically do when we work this text. Usually, when I'm talking about Matthew 7 and verse 1, I'm trying to correct people's misunderstanding. Have you done that? Have you had to try to explain to somebody, well, Jesus is not saying don't ever judge? And by the way, that is certainly true. Because if he is, he contradicts himself in the very next verse. Are you still in Matthew 7? Just look down at verse 6, the next verse, where Jesus says, "Do not give what is unholy to the dogs, and do not throw your pearls before swine, or they will trample them under their feet and turn and tear you to pieces." If I'm to obey the commandment not to throw my pearls before swine, then I will have to make a judgment about who the swine are, right? And he's not done, because if you go down to verse 15, he says this, "Beware of the false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves." And then in 16 he adds, "You will know them by their fruit." Have you put all that together and thought about what that means? Jesus says there's bad guys out there. They look good, but they're not. And so he adds, you better, watch it now, judge their fruit. Look at what they say. Look at what they do. And no matter how they appear, judge them as false teachers is what he requires. In fact, the truth is, folks, people judge all the time. We are constantly do it. Big things, little things, all kinds of different settings. In fact, do you realize that the person who says to you, don't judge, is judging you for your judging? Did y'all follow that? Should I repeat that again? I think it is correct to say that the point Jesus is making here is that when we judge, to judge fairly, to judge righteously, right? In fact, I think it is a narrow application of what he said in verse 12, Matthew 7, verse 12. Remember this, in everything, therefore, treat people the same way you want them to treat you. For this is the law and the prophets. Doesn't that sound a little like verse 2? For in the way you judge, you will be judged. Do you hear the echoes of Matthew 7, 2? So, I find myself saying that a lot. In fact, surely you've heard Jeff and I somewhere along the way essentially say that same thing about Matthew 7. Here's what I want to suggest to you this morning. I think just saying that is inadequate, because all we've done is we've corrected a misunderstanding. It's sort of like what happens a lot with the book of Revelation. I can remember doing a lot of preaching and teaching about what the book of Revelation does not teach. It does not give us a way of timing the Lord's return, or it does not teach premillennialism. But I found over the years, I didn't do nearly enough teaching about what the book does teach. We can get so busy correcting the misunderstanding that we don't create understanding of what it is that the Lord is saying in passages like this one here in Matthew 7. When we say to people, Jesus is saying, judge righteously, what does that mean? Because he requires something of us. Do you see that? In fact, I think he requires something that's hard. And can I be candid with you? Something I think sometimes we're bad at. And so maybe, rather than just correcting misunderstanding, we need to work a little harder to understand what it is that Jesus requires of us. So I want you to think with me about that for a little while this morning. What does it mean to judge righteously? And what I'd like to do is I'd like to pitch you four examples of what I think that looks like in life. And what I'm inviting you to do this morning is to judge me and what I say, okay? You can see the text in Matthew 7. I'm going to suggest four applications of that text, and you judge. Do you think these are right applications? But now here's the hard part. If they are, they're things we have to do. And I promise you they're going to be hard, because I think what the Lord requires of us here is his heart. So y'all ready to go this morning? Put on your judging hats. And here's the first thing I want to suggest to you. Number one, judging righteously means that I should be careful about judging people based on one episode in their life. That's the first thing I want you to consider. I need to be careful about judging people based on one episode in their life. You know who inspires me to say this? The Apostle Peter. So let me ask you about Peter. If we this morning were going to make a list of good guys and bad guys in the New Testament story, what list would you put Peter on? Is he a good guy or a bad guy? And I know y'all think that's a dumb question. Obviously, Peter is a good guy in this story. But I want you to know, you say that about Peter in spite of some pretty colossal blunders, right? There are some ugly chapters in Peter's story. Like that episode where Jesus is announcing his coming death. Do y'all remember that? And what did Peter say? Peter steps up and says, that's never going to happen to you, Lord. And you remember Jesus' response to him? Get behind me, Satan. Does that sound like a guy who belongs on the good list? What's worse? In Matthew 26 and verse 70, the very shadow of the cross. Peter is confronted about his affiliation with Jesus. You remember what he says? Three times. I don't know him. So the guy who betrayed the Lord, you guys are putting on the good list. What's wrong with your judgment? And I know what you're thinking, right? You're thinking, wait though, David, that's not the whole story on Peter, is it? I mean, Peter does some great stuff too. He handles his blunders well, which is awfully important in all of this. But there are other great things that Peter did. So I'm moving forward to Acts chapter 2 on the day of Pentecost, where it's Peter who's kind of the point man and standing up and saying to the crowd, you guys killed Jesus. God raised him from the dead. Well, that's a pretty good moment, right? He's going to have a moment like that before the Sanhedrin in Acts chapter 4 a little bit later. So what we're seeing is that to judge Peter fairly, you kind of got to take in all of that, don't you? By the way, isn't that the way you want people to judge you? Come on. Everybody has some chapters in their story that you don't want anyone else to read, aren't there? You got some moments you're embarrassed about where you just weren't the person that you're trying to be, right? And what I want people to do, yeah, they may see the bad. I just want them to think about the good too, and tell the whole story based on all the pieces. Matthew 7, 12. Treat others the way you want to be treated. I do think that point deserves some balance, because Jesus makes clear here in Matthew 7, there are bad players in all of this, right? There are swine and dogs, according to verse 6. Don't get mad at me. Jesus said that. There are false teachers in verse 15, and he's urging us not to be naive about that, right? And so I've got to be wise and careful. Sometimes the bad chapters pile up so much that does become the story. I guess the point is, I think we should be fair with people. In fact, that's not enough. We should be generous with people. I'm going to assume the best in the other guy. Look, if he's a bad guy, and maybe he is, he's just going to have to try really hard to prove that to me. Be careful about judging people based on one bad chapter in their story. Now, are you with me on that? Do y'all think that's a good application of Matthew 7 to judge righteously? Because if it is, I want to broaden that a little further, and I want to invite you to think with me about this. If we're going to judge righteously, I would suggest that means I need to be careful about judging an eldership based on one judgment call they made that I didn't like. How about that one? Does that get a little more uncomfortable? The reason I put that up there, folks, is because it is absolutely going to happen. When you think about how different we all are, when you look around this crowd, there are just all kinds of different people, all different ages, all kind of different levels of experiences. Our lives are very different from each other. And as a result of all of that, sometimes our judgment about things is going to be different. And then for a moment, just begin to ponder all of the different judgment calls, all the little details of our work together that somebody has to decide virtually every single week. Somebody had to make a call about services Wednesday night. Maybe some of you are thinking, I'll bring my flashlight and I'll come have class in the oven Wednesday night. Why didn't we do that, right? Because a call had to be made. And so inevitably, with all these people in our family, sometimes a call's going to be made that isn't my choice. Candidly, folks, it's that way in your own family. Maybe even sitting here right now, y'all haven't decided about lunch. Mom said, after the last week, I'm not cooking. We're going out. And so you're going to get in the car, and the question is going to be, where are we going? Right? And people may have different opinions about that. Maybe someone says barbecue, which would be an excellent choice. And someone else says, no, we need to go to Goodson's, Randy, get chicken fried steak, right? That would be a good choice. Or Mexican food. By the way, Chinese food, that's a sinful choice. Do not pick that one. Okay? That's a wrong choice. There are wrong choices in all of this. But everybody's going to have an opinion about that, right? Which means what? Someone's going to be a loser. Someone isn't going to get their way. And how do you want your children to behave if they don't get their restaurant this time? I just think I'll pout all day about that and be mad at mom and dad. That's a good plan, right? We can't even figure that out in our own family, folks. How much more a huge family like this with all the calls that have to be made? You see my point? And very often what happens in our family is elders have to collect feedback and data. And in these areas of judgment, they just have to make a call. And that call is not going to go somebody's way. Virtually every single one will have somebody who is happy with the choice it made, somebody who wishes they'd made another one. Can I plug in a little text here? I'm thinking of Philippians 2. Will you look there in your Bible? Because I think what Paul says here is helpful in this setting. Philippians 2, verse 3. Will you look there with me? Listen to this. Paul says, do nothing from selfishness, has to be my way, or empty conceit, I'm smarter than everybody else, but with humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourselves. Do not merely look out for your own personal interests, but also for the interests of others. How about that? Don't decide that shepherds are bad guys because occasionally the judgment call doesn't go my way. Now, back in Matthew 7, there's something else that I want you to see that I think we need to factor in to this piece of this before we move on. Do you remember the whole thing about the speck and the beam? Jesus warns us about trying to get the speck out of someone's eye while we got a beam in our own. Notice that he says in verse 5, you need to get the beam out of your eye because then you will see clearly. Will you underline that language in your mind? Then you will see clearly. Because I want to broaden that out and just say sometimes in some situations we don't see clearly. Are you with me about that? We're not in a good position to make sound judgments because we don't see clearly. For example, sometimes I lack the maturity to see a situation clearly. It may be that I don't agree with my shepherds in their judgment because I just don't have enough mileage on the tires. I haven't been around as long as they are. You know, that's why God says, appoint old men. Sorry, guys, this is true. Old men and men who are experienced with the word. And men who have a lot of mileage of the tire, maybe some bald spots on there, right? A lot of mileage on the tires to make those calls. Maybe I need to look at myself and say, maybe the reason I'm not on the same page is because I can't see that clearly. Maybe I can't see it clearly because it's personal to me. Maybe it involves a family member. And the problem is I am biased toward my family. Boy, boys, if we don't believe that, we're naive, right? And it may mean that I need to lean on them. Sometimes I don't see it clearly because I don't have the data. I just don't know what they know. When I served as an elder, that was one of the most frustrating things, is having a situation where you had to make a call and you base it on information you had that nobody else had, but you couldn't share it because you're protecting somebody's privacy. And so folks would be unhappy, but the problem was they just didn't know. I got to tell you, brothers and sisters, there's a trust piece that we have to have with our shepherds. And I'm going to trust their judgment here to make the right call because maybe they know some things I don't know. So when these don't always go my way, and these matters of judgment that kingdom-wise just aren't that big a deal, be okay with not getting your way every time. Don't decide the guys are bad guys because you didn't get your way about something. Question. Is that a fair application of Matthew 7 and verse 1? And this responsibility to judge righteously. Are we together on that? So let's work this out a little bit bigger. I have a third one that I want you to consider. I think if we're going to judge righteously, thirdly, we need to be careful about judging a church based on one bad season in that family. We need to be careful when we judge a church based on one bad season in that family. And I'm thinking about Jerusalem when I say that. Will you go to Acts 5. I'm thinking about the Jerusalem church when I say that. Do you remember the incident that's told at the beginning of that chapter? A husband and wife, Ananias and Sapphira. And they have a problem at that time. There are needy people among them. And so lots and lots of disciples are selling stuff to provide for the needy. Ananias and Sapphira do that, but they're frauds about it. They claim what they don't really do. And that hypocrisy winds up getting exposed. And they die there before the Lord. And it's ugly. It's a scandal. Word gets out about that. Or the disciples hear about it. The community hears about it. Can you imagine the stories you could have told about the Jerusalem church if your only chapter on that church was Acts chapter 5, Ananias and Sapphira? Man, what a wacky group of people they have there. Just a bunch of hypocrites, right? Here's my question. Would that be a fair story? Well, it's certainly not the whole story. If you back up into chapter 4, we'll ignore the chapters, Jeff. You okay with that? I knew you would be. Just back up to the last two verses of 4, because it says there, now Joseph, a Levite of Cyprian birth, who is also called Barnabas, now we know that guy, by the apostles, which translated means son of encouragement, and who owned a tract of land, sold it, and brought the money and laid it at the apostles' feet. So let's just start with that. Yes, we had some hypocrites like Ananias and Sapphira, but that's not the only people that were in that church. We also know that Barnabas is in that church. Barnabas is a good guy. He's legit. He's trying to help these needy saints not get personal glory. But actually, if you go back a little further, what you discover is that Barnabas is more characteristic of this group than Ananias and Sapphira are. Because back up in verse 32, it says the congregation of those who believed were of one heart and soul. And not one of them claimed that anything belonging to him was his own, but all things were common property to them. And with great power, the apostles were giving testimony of the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and abundant grace was upon them all, for there was not a needy person among them. For all who were owners of land or houses would sell them and bring the proceeds of the sales and lay them at the apostles' feet, and they would be distributed to each one as any had need. I would argue that actually the Jerusalem church as a whole was way more like Barnabas. Y'all agree with that? Do you see that? Than Ananias and Sapphira. And so to judge the church based on these two bad players would not have been an accurate story. And listen, we're not done, because if you back up a little further in Acts chapter 4, persecution breaks out against the disciples and the church there's facing trouble, and they come together and they pray about that, and God empowers them and they're filled with boldness and they proclaim the gospel with boldness. This is a good group of disciples. In fact, if you go ahead in chapter 5, look down at verse 16, the text goes on to say, this is post that ugly season with Ananias and Sapphira. The text goes on to say, and all the more believers in the Lord, multitudes of men and women were constantly added to their number. And so the church actually went on to do pretty well after this ugly incident. And so it just seems to me kind of like judging an individual by one episode in their life, it really isn't fair to judge a church by one ugly season. You know why I say that, right? Because every church goes through seasons. I have not, if there's one that hasn't, I haven't ever been part of it. And some of them are just really difficult and ugly. I do take encouragement from Acts chapter 5. We've never taken people out in body bags, not anywhere I've been. But I've been through some ugly seasons. Seen leaders have colossal moral failures that just damaged the body. I've seen disciples, been part of churches where disciples went through scandalous divorces and that poison leaked out and influenced other relationships and was divisive in the church. I've seen brothers and sisters who just appeared to be pillars. I had a church a few years ago that I knew about. They just had a guy, one of their key guys, a leader, and it got discovered that he was living a double life and he walked away. And I mean, it was just unbelievably awful for the group there, and just on and on and on the stories go. And when they come out and we see it, it's discouraging. It sometimes affects how we see our church family. I can tell you what it's easy to do. When those ugly seasons come, it's easy to say, something's wrong with this church. This is a bad church. I don't know, Jerusalem gives me a little bit of pause about that. Jerusalem reminds me that a season isn't the story. In fact, when a church family is going through something, can I urge you, instead of focusing on whatever the crisis is, to be sure that you look around at the other good things that are going on, because that's always been the case everywhere I've been. When there was trouble going on, there were still ladies that were going in the 2 and 3 year old class and helping those little minds begin and forming impressions about God. And there were always people who were still talking to their neighbors, trying to bring them to Christ. And there were people every day who were ministering in unknown ways to all kinds of different folks who had needs. All of that was still going on. Sometimes we just get so focused on where the problem is, we don't see all the other good, right? And then the other thing about seasons is that they always pass. Never been at a church that didn't have a season. Never been at a church where the season didn't pass. Just like here in Acts 5, verse 16. This church went on to do great stuff. They just had to go through this dark episode. I had a young lady that I know several years ago who called me up one time and said, I need a little advice. And she shared with me that the place where she was just going through an awful season. They were having a lot of trouble, some real leadership crisis in the group where she was at. And she said, you know, a lot of my friends had left. And I'm kind of thinking maybe I should just go with them. I said, tell you what, you can leave anytime. Why don't you hang on for 6 months? You can do anything for 6 months. Just hang on for 6 months and see what it looks like then. And you know what? In 6 months, the season had passed and things looked really, really different. By the way, that's not a bad life rule either. You're in a bad season of your marriage and thinking about walking away, give it 6 months and work on it. And see how it looks at the end of that time. And she ended up staying, and they're a vital part of that church family. I think we need to be careful about judging a church when it's going through a bad season. Okay, got one more for you. You with me on that? Do y'all think that's a fair application of Matthew 7? Go ahead and judge me about that. See if that works for you. The last one I'm going to give you is this. Be careful about judging all brethren because of bad experience you've had with one group of brethren, or maybe more than one. You know what inspires me to say that? Revelation 2 and 3. Will you look there in your Bible? In Revelation 2 and 3, Jesus will send a personal message to each of the seven churches that he addresses in this big letter, okay? And while all of these churches are generally in the same part of the world, As we read these letters, what we find out is that the conditions in the churches are very, very different. They're not all alike. For example, in chapter 3 and verse 7, he gives no criticism against the church at Philadelphia. He doesn't say, but I have this against you, like he does to all the other churches. And I read that and I'm thinking, wow. I mean, I'm not saying Philadelphia is perfect, but it sounds like they're doing pretty good, right? But 18 miles up the road from Philadelphia is Sardis. And in chapter 3 and verse 1, Jesus says of Sardis, you've got a name that you are alive, but you are dead. Sardis was nothing like Philadelphia. And then if you back up to chapter 2, the Ephesians, the first church address, is commended because among their problems, what they did get right was this false teaching among the Nicolaitans, and they had stood against that. That wasn't a problem. At Ephesus, they had dealt with that. But if you went up the road to Pergamum, that was not true. People at Pergamum, they had embraced that error. And so one church was getting that right, the other church was not. What's the lesson in all of that? Not all the same. Even churches very close together, like these were, can be very, very different from each other. Now, the reason I say that is because I think there can be this temptation to judge all disciples by my very limited experience with one group of disciples. And candidly, brothers and sisters, this gets done way too frequently. I know I'm getting to the end of my time, but can I ask you to really plug in on this one with me? Because I think we need to eradicate this. I hear people say all the time broad generalities about our brethren. In fact, specifically recently, I've heard people say things like this. Our brethren never talk about grace. Our brethren are unconcerned about the pornography problem that's epidemic in the world today. Our brethren just are not enthusiastic about their worship. Their worship is just lacking passion and zeal. Our elders among our brethren, are insensitive to the needs and suffering of women. A couple of things concern me when I hear people say that about every group of disciples. My first problem is that it doesn't align with my little collection of experiences. I haven't been at a church that didn't preach about grace, so that's a problem for me. I've never encountered that before. I have certainly never been to a place where folks weren't concerned about the pornography problem. My experience is exactly the opposite. And while I'm not negating his, I don't want him to negate mine either. I've seen churches all over this country who are passionately concerned about that. And I have been places where the worship was just awesome and passionate and so inspiring. So I don't know where this guy was going to church. That's just not my collection of experiences. The other concern that I have is how big of a cut of brethren does he have to make that statement? Like, how many churches have you been to? You know, Jeff and I probably do as much traveling as anybody. We do events for other churches every year, half dozen anyway. Heidi and I travel and visit other places. We do that every year. And I have to tell you, folks, I do get a sense of what's going on in other places, but I don't know that I am qualified to commenting on the level of preaching on the subject of grace in every church everywhere. That seems like a pretty bold claim. I also get kind of concerned about the potential of talk like that to be discouraging. It's one thing to say, I worship with a group where we could do worship better. It's another thing to say that all brethren worship without passion and zeal. I'm not sure I know enough to say something like that. I'm not trying to say that it's wrong to ever generalize, but I am saying we need to be very, very careful about that. Maybe we want to talk about our circle of experience and acknowledge that that's pretty small. Less bold to speak about all brethren everywhere. I think we may not be judging righteously when we do that sometimes. And that's what Matthew 7 teaches. To judge righteously. To be fair with people, even generous. To judge as we wish to be judged. So here's my question. If that is what the Lord is saying, and those are legitimate applications, do I have something I need to ponder? Maybe instead of just correcting how others are misusing the passage, there's a place for me in my life to say, you know, I could probably be more fair with people. I probably need to be more thoughtful about that. Because in the end, brothers and sisters, we will all be judged. That makes me think about the standard I use to judge others. Are you ready for that day? When you stand before the perfect judge, who will render every man to every man according to his deeds, when judgment comes, I will get exactly what I deserve. My judgment will be exactly right. How do you feel about that? Does that give you peace? Or is it terrifying? That may depend on where you are with the Lord this morning. Judgment is surely coming. And nothing more important in life than getting ready for it. Maybe you need to do that today. Maybe you need to come to the Lord for the first time. Maybe you need to come back to the Lord. This group of disciples wants nothing more than to help you with that. If you need help, here's how you let us know. We're going to sing a song and you can make your way down to the front. Do that right now while we stand, while we sing.